But the two sides never really meshed, and the software giant sold most of its stake in cable channel MSNBC in 2005. MSNBC TV struggled until it found its voice with liberal opinion hosts, but that complicated the network's ability to use MSNBC.com as its primary news portal. The site has always gotten a lot of traffic through referrals from MSN, Microsoft's landing page. That arrangement will continue, at least for now. But NBCNews.com will become the network's chief news website with a straight-ahead news approach, and MSNBC.com will become a site reflecting that TV channel's openly ideological flavor. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues at parkfoundation.org.
On November 26, 2004, station WILL AM 580 was granted a license by the Federal Communications Commission to serve the public interest as a public trustee until December 1, 2012. Our license will expire on December 1, 2012. We must file an application for license renewal with the FCC by August 1, 2012. When filed, a copy of this application will be available for public inspection during our regular business hours. It contains information concerning this station's performance during the last 8 years. Individuals who wish to advise the FCC of facts relating to our renewal application and to whether this station has operated in the public interest should file comments and petitions with the FCC by November 1, 2012. Further information concerning the FCC's broadcast license renewal process is available at Illinois Public Media, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801, or may be obtained from the Federal Communications Commission, Washington, D.C., 20554.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
Apple is the richest company in the world. It is also one of the world's most secretive companies. And by all accounts, it can be a tough place to work. At least people who work for Apple are not likely to tell you that they think their jobs are fun. At the same time, they are also quite loyal. They are working for a company, after all, that has done very well, and it is actually the richest company in the world. So the question is, well, what is the secret to Apple's success, and should others take it as a model? In this hour, we'll try to explore these and other questions as we talk with Adam Leshinsky. He is a senior editor-at-large for Fortune, where he covers Silicon Valley and Wall Street, and he is the author of a recent book that looks at Apple's corporate culture. The title of the book is Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. He is talking with us this morning by telephone. We're pleased to have some of his time. He's been with the magazine since 2001. He's written about Google, Hewlett-Packard, and Apple. He is a native of Chicago. He's also a graduate of the University of Illinois. And Adam Leshinsky, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on the station where I discovered NPR as a college student. It's very exciting for me.
Well, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Just to start out with this business of how difficult it is to get people who work for Apple to talk about what goes on inside the company, for you, was doing the research, getting people to talk to you, was that difficult?
It was difficult. Apple people are trained not to speak to anybody about what they do, and it's alarming, or with the consistency with which you will hear people in Silicon Valley say that when they try to discuss Apple with employees who may be friends of theirs or other kinds of social acquaintances, the way they clam up. The same is true for people who've left Apple, that many of them have signed non-disclosure agreements, and even if they haven't, they tend to be afraid. So it was a long and careful and sometimes tedious process, but I worked at it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. It, for companies like Apple, protecting their secrets is really important, and I would think that it would be the same at other companies like Hewlett-Packard, for example. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's really about? Is it about protecting trade secrets?
I think it's partly about protecting trade secrets, and it's partly about other things. For Apple, Apple begins with a principle. Whatever the principle is, it starts, and then it carries that out to an extreme. It behaves like almost like a religious organization or an intelligence organization. If something is worth keeping a secret, then everything is worth keeping a secret. So it's not just trade secrets from competitors, which is important. It's also the art of the reveal, the keeping secrets from you and me as consumers until they're ready to give it to us for some obvious business reasons. They don't want us anticipating the next product too much in advance of the current ones, or we might not buy the current ones. And then there are other reasons for secrecy, but those are the two main reasons for keeping secrets from outsiders.
Yeah, and the beauty of that for the company is that if people know, they have the idea that something is coming, but they don't know what, then there will be endless speculation, constant talk, constant chatter, constant mentioning of Apple, and you can't hardly put a dollar figure on that.
Well, and in fact, you can. I don't have the dollar figure in front of me. It's the only word you didn't use just now was anticipation. It's like the old ketchup commercial. The anticipation builds up to a frenzy, to the point where they get all of this free publicity. And actually, a handful of years ago, a Harvard Business School professor did quantify the free publicity that Apple gets, and I think he matched the number of media mentions with what it would cost to pay for that kind of advertising. And in fact, when Apple does new employee orientation, they cite these dollar figures to new employees as a way of explaining to them what the financial penalty is for divulging secrets.
What's interesting here, one of the things interesting about the company is that we have this image of what contemporary high-tech companies are like, what their cultures are like, that they are run from the bottom up, that they are very open places, that they're interested in keeping workers happy, and so forth and so on. People have some sense what that kind of company is all about.
Yeah.
Apple is the exact opposite.
That's right. And the archetype for what you described, the recent archetype, is Google. Mm-hmm. And before that was Hewlett-Packard, where Hewlett and Packard pioneered or at least named the concept of management by walking around and tried to create this environment, the HP way, where employees would be happy. And then Google took it to another level with the free food, the lava lamps, the beanbag chairs, and so on. Which, you know, is cliche and also absolutely true. That is the Google way. The Apple way, as you say, is completely opposite. It's a work-oriented environment where you don't come to have fun. You don't come to be entertained. You don't even come to have your feelings massaged. You know, you come to get a very important job done, and you give everything you have, and you understand every day that you're an employee at Apple that your work is about Apple, not about you. It's, you know, it sounds harsh, but if you take a step back, it's almost what the shareholders of any company would expect, but don't necessarily get.
Well, certainly that single-minded dedication to the product, to doing the best, making the best thing that you can, presenting it in the best way that you can, even packaging it in the best way that you can,
yes,
that's certainly been successful. Do you think that if Apple had, say, been more like Google, would Apple have been as successful?
Well, there's some wonky distinctions that are important, I think. One is that Google is an internet company and Apple is not. Apple is a device manufacturing company. This is central to understanding the culture of the two companies. So for making hardware and only coming out with products every once in a while, say 5 or 6 times a year, as opposed to being able to iterate on them every day, which is what an internet company can do, this sort of culture is very important to Apple. So to answer your question more briefly, yes, I think if Apple had been a more freewheeling place, it would not have been as successful. And in fact, in the 80s, when Steve Jobs was gone, in the 90s, from the company, it was more like that. It leaked like a sieve, as they said, and it was far less disciplined and far less successful.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Adam Leshinsky. He's senior editor-at-large for Fortune, where he covers Silicon Valley and Wall Street. He's the author of a recently published book, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This single-mindedness, this idea that they were going to do a small number of products and make them as good as they can. And if people have ever looked at Apple products, you know that there aren't a lot of models, there aren't a lot of choices. You know, famously, they said they could display on the top of a relatively small table everything that they made.
Yep.
That idea, did this all really come ultimately from Steve Jobs?
Yes, it really did. I mean, every idea that was important at Apple in the modern era, which is defined as 1997 onward from when he came back to the company that he co-founded, emanates from Steve Jobs. He had an aesthetic of simplicity. Now, whether this was from his time that he spent in India studying Buddhism, or whether it was the calligraphy course he took at Reed College in Oregon, or whether it was just innate in him, we may never know, but simplicity was part of his personal ethos and his business ethos. And so he hit on something that worked very well for a consumer company, which was to only try to do a few things and to do them as simply as possible. What's fascinating about Apple is that, and I describe in the book, is that they extend this simplicity out into everything else in the company. And so it's not just product design, but everything they do, from marketing to organizational structure to the design of their products. Hmm.
We have a caller here, someone in Belgium, not far away from us, here on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. And I'm going to open up something with you about Apple that I find very interesting with the comments you've just made about their desire to keep everything so closed-mouthed and everything. In the news very recently, we're hearing a lot about Foxconn. Foxconn is where they make a lot of Apple products. And Foxconn is not a Chinese firm. It's actually owned by a Taiwanese group. Now, Apple goes into China, a place where people rip off things all the time and pirate them and sell them in other ways. But Apple doesn't seem to have that problem. Apple goes through Taiwan. The Taiwanese have a relationship with China, which is changing the relationship that Taiwan and China has with themselves. This little situation that's going on here between China and Apple is much bigger than I think we think about every day.
Well, I don't know. Adam, can you respond to that?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on how Apple is able to avoid getting ripped off by the Chinese, other than that I think for a variety of reasons Foxconn runs a very tight ship in China. And you're right, Foxconn is a company that is based in Taiwan but does the bulk of its manufacturing in China. It's worth pointing out that most big Western companies, that includes the Koreans and the Japanese, use virtually the same Foxconn factories in China that Apple uses. We really haven't addressed the fact that the working conditions are universal at these Foxconn factories for the major Western manufacturers. I think that Apple has a very tight grip on what goes on at the Foxconn factories that it uses, and this explains why its designs, by and large, have not been ripped off. I don't have anything to add more about the relationship between Foxconn and the Chinese government, other than that they've been in for years and it's a well-oiled machine.
Exactly, that's exactly what I'm getting at. How interesting that Apple would choose that way to go there and be so intelligent about it. Just like you say, they do everything simple.
Well, let me comment on that, because it's actually an interesting little piece of Apple history. This was something that before 1998, Apple did extremely poorly. They had their own factories and warehouses in the United States and elsewhere. And when the very last member of the modern Apple executive team to be hired was Tim Cook, who was working at the time at Compaq. He today is the CEO of Apple. He was a supply chain and logistics and manufacturing expert. And when Jobs hired him, he came in and said, okay, who's the best in the industry at making computers? The answer was Dell. He said, how does Dell do it? They use contract manufacturers in China. That's how we're going to do it. That's the history. Apple was simply and blatantly copying Dell in the late 1990s when it set up these factories in China.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. You talked a little bit earlier about some of what we know about Jobs and his life and what might possibly have been his influences and what leads him to take the approach that he took at Apple. One thing that I think is interesting is that he said that he was also very influenced by the Disney company and its approach to things.
Yes. Walt Disney's attitude was that, there was a big difference between the public image of Disney and what went on behind the scenes, almost the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain type metaphor. And so Walt Disney ran a very secretive shop internally when there were, I write in the book that when they were working on Walt Disney World for the first time, there were internal reports that were watermarked so that if they got out, management would know who leaked them out. And there's a very strong comparison here between the wonderful, public, whimsical, happy image we all have of Apple from its advertising and the very, as I said, work-oriented, harsh environment internally. Those are two different things, and that's exactly how Jobs intended for it to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thinks about these surveys that show that not only are Apple products popular, and certainly they've come to dominate some segments, that people also have said that they admire the company. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it's, famously it's said to be the world's most admired company. It's in the subtitle of your book.
Yes.
Do you think, or do the people at Apple think that if consumers, if the general public had a better idea what the corporate culture inside Apple was like and what it was like to work for Apple, that it would not be the most admired company?
Well, and in fact, my magazine, Fortune Magazine, just published the annual list of the world's most admired companies, and Apple's number one again. And to your question, whatever that means, I believe, and I can follow up with you on this, that's a survey of business people on which companies they admire. They're admired, obviously, because they're so successful. To your question, will consumers change their opinion? Immodestly, I think my book will inform consumers for the first time about what goes on behind the scenes at Apple. Having said that, my instincts tell me that consumers are very comfortable practicing a cognitive dissonance when it comes to Apple, and the labor issue is a perfect example. Certain people in the human rights community who are interested in human rights are very upset about their perception of the working conditions at the factories that Apple contracts with in China. And yet, there's no visible evidence that consumers have pulled back from buying Apple products. And these are not new issues. These issues have been known for years. So if people have pulled back because of their outrage, it's a relatively insignificant number of people who've done it. Mm.
Well, as you say, that there people have known about this for some time. Recently, there's been a kind of an uptick in
yep.
negative publicity about the working conditions for people who make the products.
Yes.
How do people at Apple think about that?
Well, my sense is that that Apple people, all the way up to the CEO, care about this issue. I think number one, they feel persecuted on this. They feel picked on, would be a better way of putting it. They are unused to, believe it or not, being number one. They have an underdog mentality at Apple because from a corporate perspective, they were the underdog for a very long time. So they, I think it's unfair that they're being singled out for practices that the whole industry uses. Eventually, they're going to come to realize that when you're Apple and you're number one, you get treated like number one, and those are the breaks. I think they feel that they are trying their best to address the issues. I think they care. I think that's why they published the supplier report and why they've, exhaustively audited the work conditions and published the results of those audits. They think they've done a better job of publishing the results than their competitors have. And, you know, and I think that's as far as they've gone right now, so far emotionally and thinking about the issue.
Yeah, I think it's you pointed something that's worth at least keeping in mind, and that is we now think of Apple as being hugely successful, very valuable, admired by other business people, and certainly a very important force in the world of tablets and smartphones. But that the golden age of Apple really only goes back, what, about 15 years maybe?
That's exactly right, and even less if you consider that 97 is when Steve Jobs returned to the company, but it wasn't until, you know, 2003 or 4 or so that it was understood by everybody that the iPod and iTunes had made Apple a raging success and a complete turnaround story. Yes, the iMac came in 1998, but just because that one product was successful didn't mean that everybody understood that Apple was back in the way that it is today. So, it, you know, the golden age, I would argue, has been more like less than 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And that we do think of it as a computer company, and yet computers are really a pretty small part of what they do.
It's shocking. It's less than 20% of revenues is associated with the Macintosh now. The iPhone is the product that is driving the company, followed by the iPad. And the fascinating thing about that is that the Macintosh is a fantastic business for Apple right now. It's growing at twice the rate of the rest of the PC industry, and yet it's growing more slowly than any other part of Apple and accounts for the smallest portion of revenues of any major product for Apple. And one last point about the Macintosh computer, it's also a cash cow for Apple right now. It generates a tremendous amount of profit. And is growing, not shrinking its market share, which means that Apple has the ability to take great risks in other areas of its business, partly because of the Macintosh business and partly because it has $100 billion of cash on its balance sheet.
Yeah. And clearly the place where things are booming, and it's maybe not just for Apple, but the place where things are booming are mobile devices. And again, particularly we're talking about tablets and smartphones, a place where Apple has a very significant advantage. They may not have it forever, but I think people expect they're going to continue to have it for a while. And that's the way people are going. They're going to want to get data, and they're going to want to get media on mobile devices. Did Apple create this or this demand, or is it in some way that they're actually following the demand, or is it some of both?
It is some of both. As with almost everything that Apple's done over the past 15 years, it didn't invent any of this. It's just a fascinating part of the Apple story that people who don't spend a year studying it the way I have don't stop and think about, perhaps, in that, you know, there were MP3 players before the iPod came along. There were smartphones before the iPhone came along. And, in fact, there were tablet computers before the iPad came along. It's just that Apple has done these three things better than anybody else had done them before. And Apple isn't perfect, by the way. They don't see everything. When they introduced the iPhone in 2007, there was no App Store. And so third-party software developers started hacking into the iPhone to create their own apps, and Apple saw this and said, oh, well, maybe we should make a place for them to sell these apps instead, and we could make some money, and it would be a safer experience for the user than these hacks. So they created the Apple App Store, which now is this giant business that absolutely is generating demand and moving the mobile industry forward. And so there is this chicken and egg thing with Apple. The iPhone has been so successful and is such a quantum leap above what existed that new things are happening because of it.
Yeah, but you'd think that because they had the model of the iTunes and selling music that way, that someone would have thought, hey, you know, we could do apps like this.
You'd think, and the difference is this, and this is very Apple. With iTunes, they went and did a small number of deals. You can count the important ones on one hand with the record companies, with the labels. And so that's how music came onto the iTunes store, was through these very specific and very large commercial agreements with the record companies. The mindset for doing an app store and having you know, some kid in his apartment creating an app that can be a very successful free or $1 game, I should say 99-cent game, was not part of the Apple mindset. That was something they had to come around to. Hmm.
Let's go back and talk a little bit more about what it's like to work for Apple, beginning with what happens when you get hired at Apple.
First of all, Apple values experts. They do not want people with general business sense. They want people who are very good at something. Steve Jobs would brag that Apple had the best metallurgists in the world on staff. This is because they do such interesting work with metal on the iPhone and the MacBook, for example. And so when you're hired at Apple, because you're an expert and you know that Apple is so excellent, you aren't necessarily put on a specific project. You won't necessarily be told exactly what it is that you'll be working on. And this is in part so you won't go blabbing about it beforehand, but also even though Apple's decided that you're excellent, they haven't decided if you can be trusted, and you need to be watched a little bit once you come into the organization before you will be trusted. It's very important also that Apple determine that you've got the right personality to work at Apple. People either sink or swim early on in their time at Apple, and you need to figure out early on if you're going to be the kind of person who can subsume their ego to the greater good and glory of Apple, and that's not a no-brainer. But just because you're very good at what you do means that you can do that.
Yeah. So it's common to hire people into the company without even telling them what they'll be doing when they go to work there?
Yes, it is. They may know what division, for example, they're going to work on, but not what their specific project will be. Because after all, you may be working on a new project, and why in the world would you allow someone who's not even an employee yet to know what that project is when their own colleagues don't know what it is?
Yeah, and that's also interesting about this corporate culture and how important secrecy is, that people are very single-minded. They're assigned to a particular task. They're supposed to work on that one thing and not worry about or think about what other people are doing. And in fact, people don't know what other people are doing. It's possible that your boss, maybe your supervisor in the company, might not know what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't know if your supervisor wouldn't know what you're doing. What I do know is people have told me repeatedly that their security badges gave them access to certain places that their bosses did not have access to. You know, whatever task was going on in that room was not a task that their boss might be performing, and so that person wouldn't have access to the room. This internal secrecy, I think, is unique to Apple. It's something I've never heard of at another company, where you are discouraged from speaking about work or about what you're working on with anyone, and that includes your own colleagues, unless they're specifically on your team. Now, this is part of the secrecy that we spoke about earlier, same goals. But I recognized over the course of my research there's another goal, whether it's intended or unintended, I can't tell you, but people would tell me over and over that there was very little politicking at Apple, and we know that politics is rife in corporate America. And at first I thought, this is a line that people tell journalists, I don't really buy it. The more I heard it, the more I came to realize that without any information, it's very difficult to play politics. And so Apple people don't play politics because they don't know what to talk about to play politics.
Yeah. So it's really true that you could come in on a Monday morning and you would find there might be a wall or a door where there wasn't one before.
And, that's right.
And that maybe you could go in the door or maybe not.
Well, as I describe it in the book, if you didn't know what's going on behind that door, or if there was transparent glass one day and frosted glass the next day, that was a sure signal to you that you were not involved with what was going on behind that door, and you didn't ask. It's not the Apple culture to inquire. The Apple culture is to mind your own business.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Adam Leshinsky. He's senior editor-at-large for Fortune, where he covers Silicon Valley and Wall Street. He's been on the staff of the magazine since 2001, has written about Google, Hewlett-Packard, and Apple. His new book is Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Business Plus is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Have people been fired for talking about their work?
At Apple?
At Apple, yeah.
It's the sort of thing that I don't have any direct evidence, but I believe that they have been. Yes, they've been fired for divulging secrets.
Yeah, for what happened to that guy? I want people to remember the story where somebody left a prototype iPhone in a bar.
Yeah.
Did they ever find out what happened to that? You ever find out what happened to that guy?
No, I get asked that a lot, and I don't know specifically. I should find out. It's a popular conspiracy theory that Apple instructs these people to leave those prototypes lying around occasionally to gin up some controversy and publicity before an event. I don't believe the conspiracy theory. I think these prototypes for various companies get left places from time to time all over the industry. It's just that the four or five times that it happens with Apple, it becomes headline news because it's Apple. Hmm.
The thing I'm sure that people, again, the thing that people always ask, and you've been probably asked a million times now, is what happens to the company, what will happen to the company now that Steve Jobs is no longer running it?
I've been asked it many times, but I don't get tired of discussing it because it's one of these things like, what is the meaning of life? You know, everyone has an opinion, but no one can tell you for sure. My answer is that I think the company will face a tremendous number of challenges because it's impossible to overstate how central Steve Jobs was to what happens at Apple. I also think that the company has been through the most extraordinary 15-year run in the history, perhaps of the modern corporation, and that even if Steve Jobs were alive and well today, there's no way they could have another 15 years like the last 15 years. Now, having said all that, what I believe people underestimate is how much excellence there is in the company. I'll give you an example: the entire current executive team, the 10 or so people who ran the company under Steve Jobs, have all been at the company since at least 2000. So these are people who studied for a minimum of 12 years at the knee of Steve Jobs and learned his processes. He worked very hard to institutionalize a lot of the things that Apple does. So the culture, I think, will continue on for quite a long time. And I think that to the extent that they make mistakes, they'll make mistakes adhering to their own principles. I think it will continue to be a great company. The question is if it can continue to be an insanely great company, to use Steve Jobs' expression. And I doubt that. I doubt any company can continue to be insanely great for 30 years.
Yeah. All right. We have some other callers here, someone who must clearly be listening on the Internet. They're in Scottsdale, Arizona, line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hey.
Yeah,
hey,
hi.
Adam, Bob Livingston by name. I'm just curious. I mean, you are a journalist and you're an investigative journalist and you do a great deal of research. You know, as you went through, you know, all of the study and all of the, you know, interviewing and all of the investigative work that you do, tell me what perhaps was the biggest surprise that came out of all of this study and all of this detailed investigation and interviews that you did. What was the really, really big surprise that you didn't expect?
Thanks for the question. I think what surprised me is how unbelievably consistent Apple is. So you can speak to people who left the company a month ago. You can speak to people who left the company 5 years ago. And these people will never have met each other. And you ask them a question about how the company operates, and the answers will be almost exactly the same. They have an otherworldly ability to communicate to their own people internally what the message and what the mission of the company is, to the point where those people can repeat it back perfectly. It's even more astounding if you think about it, given what I've said about the internal secrecy and the fact that they don't tell people so much. They do tell people enough to give them this ability to be so consistent. And by the way, this consistency also speaks to their external behavior, and you'll see this on Wednesday when they release whatever new products they're going to release around the iPad. They will communicate their message very clearly and consistently to the point that we in the press will repeat their lines verbatim, and then our readers and listeners will repeat their lines verbatim to their friends, and everybody else will start repeating them verbatim. So that I think that's what surprised me the most.
That's interesting.
Well, thanks for the call. Thank you. So, but how is that? There must be some very clear and tight mechanism within the company to communicate that to the workers so that then they will imbibe that and embody that and then repeat that back. Now, how does that happen?
Yeah. So Apple, as I think you said at the very outset, is a top-down organization where there's very clear direction from the top. It's also a manage-up organization. So people are constantly preparing their boss or their boss's boss or their boss's boss to present to the executive team, the top 10 executives or so. And so there's a constant flow of information, where appropriate, up and down the food chain at Apple. And so matters of policy or behavior or culture would be communicated clearly down the chain from one person to their subordinates to their subordinates, to the point where Apple people have a very clear understanding of what's expected of them because their boss told them so.
All right. To Champaign County, back here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, one aside, which is that this Foxconn plant, I understand that it is, one of the big ones is 450,000 workers, nearly a half a million workers. I don't know if that's around the clock. I assume it is. But anyway, that's where all the tablets, a lot of the tablets are built for everybody that markets tablets. But I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if there's enough time to do this right, but some concrete episodes, and that would be, it's the way I remember it, Jobs was sort of fixated with video when MP3 players were coming out, and that they were actually late arrivals to it. And I just wonder if something that never gets commented on is that they actually use a musical format, AAC, that's better than MP3. And I don't know how many people are discerning listeners and that can actually tell the difference, but I've never heard anybody really comment on the fact that they, part of the success might be not just the integrated design of the iStore, but the fact that they actually have a more pleasant listening format. So the other thing is the episode with Motorola, IBM, and around the further development of the PowerPC chip, which I still think is better. I'm not a computer scientist, but the RISC chip versus the CISC chip just seemed, I was always quite persuaded in that. I was rather disappointed that it all fell apart. And it seemed to be that it was not really a scientific decision. And do you get into the details of the machinations between Motorola, IBM, and Apple? And I guess I'll hang up and listen because there's probably not too much time left.
Yeah, okay.
Well, first of all, I'll start with your audio format question. And I don't get into any of these technical details in this book because it's a business book. And I talk about culture and decision-making and attitude more than these specific things. But what your example speaks to is that Apple, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, usually is not first to a new product. And they often are best in that they will do what they think is the best way of doing something. You know, the glass will be more beautiful, for example. You point out that the sound quality, the technical standard that they used on the iPod was better than the existing products. But it also speaks to, whenever possible, they try to do something that is unique to them, and they don't necessarily care if it's the way everybody else is doing it. And that also speaks to their approach to semiconductors. For years, as you point out, they used the PowerPC, and then they shifted to Intel. My understanding, not because of any sort of business imperative, but because they felt that Intel had caught up from a power perspective and from a power use perspective. Around the same time, they also bought their own semiconductor manufacturer, which is a fabless manufacturer, meaning that they don't have semiconductor manufacturing capability of their own, but they have their own design. And those chips are now used throughout most of their non-PC products. And this just speaks to Apple's willingness to go its own way.
All right. Again, to San Francisco. Line two. Hello.
Hi there. I read your book, and it's really great. I really appreciate it. So the real question that I had after reading was, do you think another company could learn from Apple and do what Apple does and be successful, or is it just Apple does so many things that are different and it's put them together in the right mix that they are kind of unique, and the lessons are They all work when you do them all, and you have a Steve Jobs kind of leading the culture. So, and I'll take my comments offline.
Yeah, thanks.
So I think that there's a don't try this at home aspect to the way Apple works. A company does not want to try to copy the Apple culture because they would fail. However, I think there's elements of what Apple does that absolutely every company and even every person in their own career can do. I think there's not a company out there that couldn't hone its marketing message better the way Apple does. I think every company could ask itself, do we do a good enough job of rejecting bad ideas or even good ideas that we're not in a position to do right now, which is something that Apple does very well. And then something I learned working on the book from a career management perspective, I found it absolutely humbling to realize that Apple people are not multitaskers. They're extremely focused. This enables them to get a lot done and to achieve the excellence that they achieve. Most of us are multitaskers, and I think we need to at least ponder the way Apple does things and ask ourselves, is their way a better way, and if so, could we be more focused and less scattered than some of us are? And I'm putting myself at the front of that line.
About 10 minutes left. Our guest in this hour, Adam Leshinsky, works for Fortune magazine. He's senior editor at large. He's the author of the recent book, Inside Apple. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. One of the other features that seems to be really special about Apple is that design leads. Design leads everything. The people who are the most clearly most prestigious people in the company were the designers. And I think a lot of people would agree that they are beautifully designed products. Even the packaging is beautiful. Everything about it is beautiful. Where did that come from? Was that also something that Steve Jobs brought to the company?
There's no question. There's this common misperception, by the way, that the head of design for Apple, Jonathan Ive, that Jobs hired him or that Jobs promoted him to be head designer. Neither is true. Ive actually was hired under the previous regime, and he was actually promoted under the previous regime to be the head of design for Apple. Jobs discovered him, if you will, working away on his prototypes, including a prototype for what became the candy-colored iMac. And Jobs found, in a sense, a professional soulmate in Jonathan Ive, someone who had this simple design aesthetic. Now, what Jobs did as a business manager was to elevate Ive and his team to this high level of importance that you referenced. And this seems like a soft topic, you know, level of importance, but it's so important in that at Apple, a financial person would never tell Jonathan Ive, well, we can't do that because it'll cost too much, or we don't know how to purchase the machinery that could do what you're suggesting. In the Apple of the last 15 years, Ive would say, no, this is what it's going to look like, and this is the material I want to use. Now you go figure out how to pay for it or how to find it. That's a radical difference from the way almost every other company would approach that topic. And as I said earlier, I think this is an element of Apple's culture that won't change. Design will remain preeminent. Now, that doesn't mean that they'll have the right designs. They still need to get it. They need to get that right. And I think they'll either succeed that way or they'll indeed fail that way. But they won't all of a sudden let the bean counters, if you will, start calling the shots.
Yeah, and I think it seems to me that this whole business of design and the fact that so much attention is paid to that has something to do with the fact that it seems to me that Apple people they feel an emotional connection with the product that I think other people, you know, people love their iPods. I'm sure Dell is, you know, they make fine products, but I don't know that people are in love with their machines the way Apple people are in love with their machines.
I think everything you said is completely right, and you're actually being kind in the way that you said it. And the example I use in the book to drive home the point, the really fun anecdote, is that there's a website called Cupid Tino, a mashup of Cupid, the god of love, I guess, or love making, and Cupertino. This is a website devoted, a dating website devoted to people who love Apple products. It's a very cool site to look at because it's basically an homage to Apple design. You know, it's to use your example, it's it would be preposterous to think of a dating site devoted to Dell lovers.
Yeah. And I'm sitting right now in front of a Dell machine. I got nothing against Dell, but just that was the thing that popped into my head. Let's talk with another caller here. In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I like to listen to your program. I have no expertise in this field, but I was listening, and I always thought Apple was great. I worked in a school. We were sold on Apple products. But if I worked for a company that was that controlling, I would feel like that they are literally brainwashing their employees. I mean, they pay them well, but they have such control that it really changes how I look at the whole company.
And you know, and my response would be that, and I've given this a lot of thought, that you clearly would not be an appropriate person to work at Apple, and there's nothing wrong with that. It takes all types, and this is the type. This is the type that I've described is the type that has made this company a $500 billion market cap company. And so I sort of, as a journalist, I respect the value judgment that you're making, and it's a different one from the one that Apple employees make. And so far, I think you're in the minority of consumers, but it's a valid position on your part.
I'm sure I am, but what if they are victims and they don't even know they're victims?
Well,
and
I would
I'll
only
hang up and.
Yeah.
As a point of discourse, I would challenge you. You used an interesting word, brainwashing. You know, another word would be propaganda. And I would say there's a continuum of, you know, all companies have mission statements, and all CEOs give pep talks to the workforce and say this is how we're going to do things, and all companies do marketing. And so there's a, you know, one man's brainwashing is another man's encouragement, and one man's propaganda is another man's marketing.
We've got a couple of minutes left here. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit, or at least speculate about where the company is heading. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly a lot of people would acknowledge the fact that Apple has changed dramatically the way people buy and listen to music. Well, I think that there are also people who think there's great potential for them doing that same thing with television. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going on or will be going on now in the future with Apple and TV?
Well, historically, I'll just draw one distinction for you between what Apple did with music and what Apple and others will be trying to do with television. Apple swooped into the music scene at a time when music theft and piracy were all the rage, and Apple was really the first to say, here is an elegant, legal, commercial solution to this music stealing subject. Today, the industry, the television and film industry, have the benefit of having watched 10 years of piracy and 10 years of Apple successfully, almost 10 years, successfully selling music. And so I think Apple is going to do some, will come to the market with some incredibly provocative and fresh approaches to buying filmed entertainment online, but they won't be the only ones. There'll be multiple approaches to doing it. And indeed, there already are. If you think of Amazon or Netflix and some of the captive solutions that some of the entertainment companies have, I think it will be a great, this is cliche, but it'll be a great time for consumers because there'll be a lot of options, including Apple's option. Whereas when iTunes came around, it was basically steal music or buy it from iTunes.
Yeah, so you think people will come to accept the idea that when it comes to movies or, well, television particularly, now that we're used to the idea of free television, that with television it's going to be a pay-per-view kind of thing?
Well, no. I mean, I think, remember, we've had pay television for decades as well through cable, and so it'll be a menu of options, and I think there'll be real good pay per view, and there'll be really good advertising supported. Hulu alone is a good example of that right now. They have an advertising model that's free, and they have a pay model that requires a subscription. We'll see more of that sort of behavior in the marketplace, I think.
Yeah. One other thing that I think that Apple has done that's really important, significant, you have to acknowledge, is that it has really changed the way that people interact with their devices, and that probably the last big step on that along that road is Siri. We've got people now talking to their phones and asking them questions, and the phone is talking back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, you wonder how long is it going to be till we got computers with that kind of voice recognition and generating software, and more people will be interacting with the machines that way. Do you have some sort of sense about how people at Apple are thinking about this whole business of the interface with the hardware?
Yeah. Well, and once again, you know, I don't need to cheerlead for Apple, but they've taken something in terms of artificial intelligence and human interaction with computers that has been, you know, a subject of intense study in the computer industry for decades, and they've gone and commercialized it and got the rest of us talking about it in the way that nobody else had before them. I know that they are interested, for example, in wearable computers, and so they're giving a lot of thought to all of this. They're very good at thinking very far out and then bringing something to the market at the moment that the market is ready for it. And they did this with the iPhone, with the multi-touch technology as well.
Well, there, I think we'll have to finish up with the promise that if people are interested in, or the suggestion that people are interested in reading more about what happens inside Apple, the book to look for is the book we mentioned, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Business Plus is the publisher. Our guest, Adam Leshinsky, is the author. He's senior editor at large for Fortune, where he covers Silicon Valley and Wall Street. And Adam, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Join us in September for WILL's Civil War Train. Board vintage train cars for stops in Vicksburg, Atlanta, Kennesaw Mountain, Chickamauga, and New Orleans. Visit the Smithsonian Southern and Southeast Railway Museums and see Civil War-era Washington, D.C. The trip is nearly sold out. Call 217-333-7300 or visit www.will.illinois.edu/willtravel for more information.
On tomorrow's Focus, over the past 100 years, the U.S. lost two-thirds of its family-operated farms. We'll bring you the story of one such farm as we talk with Robert Switzer, author of A Family Farm. The book tells the story of life on a northern Illinois dairy farm beginning in 1916, the time of the author's grandparents. The story ends when the farm is sold in 1991. The author says millions of these stories, often sad ones, could be told, but they are rapidly being lost. It's a rebroadcast from May of this year. Conversation with Dr. Robert Switzer, Professor Emeritus of Biochemistry at the University of Illinois, A Family Farm, Life on an Illinois Dairy Farm. Then in the 11 o'clock hour of the program, a conversation with Dr. Rachel Herz, Adjunct Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Human Behavior at Brown University, about her book, That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion, another conversation from May of this year. On Wednesday's show, we'll be live. We'll have a conversation with Janine McLaughlin, food writer and blogger and founder of the Rustic Kitchen Cooking School, also the author of Farmers Markets of the Heartland. We'll also be joined by Lisa Brawlitz, Economic Development Specialist Director for Urbana's Market at the Square in the city of Urbana. The Market at the Square, that farmer's market, is among those featured in the book. And we'll have a conversation about, of course, farmers markets. Is the food really all that different? What controls are in place to ensure quality and freshness? How do you really know you're getting higher quality that you pay for? That conversation on Wednesday at 10. That's what's ahead on Focus in the next couple of days. Stay with us. Let's get you updated now on the commodity markets. The latest tick, Kansas City wheat for September's at 8.79 1/4. That's up 28 1/4. December wheat at 8.97 3/4, up 26 3/4. Chicago wheat for September at 8.78 1/4, up 30 1/2. December wheat at 8.93, also up 30 1/2. September corn at 771.5, up 31. December corn at 771.25, up 31. August soybeans at 626, or make that 1626.5, up 31.75. September beans at 1602.75, up 33.25. August soybean meals trading at 484.80, up 10.70. September soybean meal at 476.90, up 11.30. August soybean oils at 54.45, up 75 cents. September soybean oil at 54.66, also up 75. August live cattle's at 116.72.5, that's down 47.5 cents. October live cattle at 120.65, down 80 cents. August feeder cattle at 136 even, that's up $3. September feeder cattle at 139.15, also up. Let me make a correction on both of those. August feeder cattle's at 136, that's down $3. September feeder cattle at 139.15, also down $3. July lean hogs trading at 96.92.5, down 30 cents, and August lean hogs at 90.20, down 20 cents in trading on the day. This is WILL 580 AM and